Okay, so we wanted to really get into this one, a deep dive into the Nova Scotia mass casualty. We're going through some pretty heavy stuff here. Excerpts from volumes 2, 3, 4, and 5 of the Mass Casualty Commission's final report.
You know, even just skimming them, it's tough going.
Yeah.
But what really struck me is that they didn't just recount the events, you know, they really try to get at the why, like examining the perpetrator's history, the police response, the community, the warning systems, you know, everything.
22 people killed, a gunman on the loose for hours. And then, to make things even more confusing, he was driving a replica RCMP cruiser.
It's awful. Yeah. It's hard to even process it all. But like you said in your request, we need to understand how this happened to even begin to think about preventing future tragedies.
Exactly. And to do that, I think we really need to start with the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
These reports paint a very disturbing picture of his behavior.
Stretching back decades, right?
Okay.
This wasn't just a couple of isolated incidents. Oh, no. Not at all. This was a persistent pattern of violence and intimidation.
Domestic violence against his spouse. Assaults. Threats, not just towards people he knew either, strangers too.
Yeah. It really makes you wonder how, you know, how did all these warning signs go unheeded for so long?
And that seems to be one of the core questions the commission is grappling with, right? Those missed opportunities for intervention.
Yeah. Like there were so many instances where someone could have stepped in, you know, like those complaints to the police about his illegal firearms.
Right.
They weren't properly investigated.
And you think about that domino effect, right?
Yeah.
Like one missed opportunity leads to another and another, and eventually you have something horrific like this happening.
It's really hard to even fathom.
There are so many disturbing details in this case, but one that I just can't get over is the replica RCMP cruiser.
It's chilling.
The report details how meticulously he created it, you know? He literally transformed a decommissioned police car into a near-perfect replica.
Yeah. Decals. A light bar, even an RCMP uniform.
Like the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
And he even used a government auction site to buy the car. It's just troubling how easy it seems to have been.
And the commission really, they really call for much stricter regulations on these kinds of sales, especially of police equipment.
Which makes sense.
Because a number of people who knew him, including his spouse and family, they actually raised concerns about the cruiser.
Yeah, those warnings were ignored.
Think about it. What if someone had taken those concerns seriously?
Right.
It's just heartbreaking to think that maybe something could have been done. You know?
Yeah.
It's a reminder that we all have a responsibility to be vigilant, to notice those red flags and to speak up.
Yeah.
Because you never know.
And then on that night in Porto Peak, April 18th, 2020.
Yeah.
That quiet rural community, it just became this scene of unimaginable terror.
Yeah. And the replica cruiser, you know, it really played a role in that.
Oh, absolutely.
People saw a police car, and their first thought wouldn't be danger.
Right.
It was the opposite of that. It was supposed to mean safety. And he totally exploited that trust.
Yeah.
You know?
And just reading through the timeline of events is
difficult.
So difficult, yeah. It seems like the RCMP's initial response was just riddled with confusion and communication breakdowns, you know? Mm-hmm. They were dealing with something that they had never encountered before.
Yeah, it was unprecedented.
And he clearly exploited that.
Yeah, and the commission really criticizes how the RCMP communicated with the public during that time. You know, like there was a significant delay in issuing that public alert through the alert ready system.
Right.
And even when they did start releasing information, it was often inaccurate or incomplete.
Yeah. And that seems to be a recurring theme throughout the reports, right? This lack of clear communication.
Yeah, had devastating consequences.
Because he managed to evade the police overnight and continued his attacks in other communities the next day. It's hard to believe that, you know, in this day and age with all the technology we have, something like this could still happen.
It is. And it's a sobering reminder that technology is only as good as the people using it, you know? Without the proper training, clear communication, and willingness to adapt, even the most advanced systems can fail. And it's not just about pointing fingers at the RCMP. It's about recognizing these systemic vulnerabilities that we all need to be aware of.
The commission lays out this really detailed plan for preventing future tragedies. And their recommendations are, they're wide-ranging. They address gender-based violence, improving rural policing, enhancing public warning systems. It's a lot.
Yeah.
But we've been focusing a lot on the big picture. Mm-hmm. To really understand how this happened, we need to kind of zoom in on the perpetrator himself. You mentioned earlier that his professional life as a denturist played a role. What did you mean by that?
Oh, it's disturbing, but it's something we see a lot in cases of abuse. He used his position and his money to manipulate people, especially vulnerable individuals in marginalized communities.
He built trust just to betray it in the most horrific way.
Yeah.
The report mentions a number of complaints about the perpetrator that were filed with the denturist licensing board. Accusations of harassment and intimidation of his patients. And it seems like these complaints weren't really handled effectively.
Yeah, and that raises some really important questions about how we regulate these professions.
Mm.
You know, are these organizations equipped to deal with accusations that might point to criminal behavior? Do they have the resources, the power to actually intervene?
Right.
It seems like another missed opportunity to maybe stop him.
Yeah, it's almost as if there was this collective blindness to the danger that he posed. And that pattern of ignoring these warning signs, it shows up in his personal life too. The reports, they showed that his controlling and violent behavior was known by friends, family, even law enforcement.
Right.
But no one took any decisive action.
It's chilling. It's a chilling example of how silence protects abusers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they thrive in environments where people are afraid to speak up, where those warning signs are dismissed, and where there's just no accountability. This is something that we, as a society, we really need to address.
You mentioned that he bought the replica cruiser through a government auction site. Was that legal?
It was. It was legal at the time.
It just seems unfathomable that anyone could just buy a decommissioned police car so easily.
I know. It's hard to believe. But the commission, they raised some really serious concerns about how easy it was to get those vehicles. You know, there weren't any background checks.
Yeah.
No vetting process.
It's pretty shocking.
And then getting the decals and the police equipment. It didn't seem to be difficult either.
The report mentions a witness who saw him getting decals and an RCMP uniform. It's terrifying how he was able to create this illusion of authority piece by piece.
Yeah. And the commission even suggests that, you know, maybe that easy access to those things might have played a role in his ability to carry out the attacks.
Yeah.
You know, the cruiser helped him avoid detection.
Right.
And it really created that fear and confusion in the community.
It's like even these seemingly mundane objects, they can be twisted and used for horrific purposes.
Yeah, it's a sobering thought.
So with this history of violence, access to firearms, and this meticulously crafted facade of authority with the replica police car. But then what happened when the shooting began? What were those initial missteps in the RCMP's response?
Well, the cruiser itself, it caused a ton of confusion early on.
You know, I bet.
Because the officers who were responding to Portapique, they couldn't be sure who was a legitimate officer and who was the perpetrator.
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought of that. Just the chaos that must have created for everyone involved, and especially potential victims who might have approached the cruiser for help.
Exactly. The report even details how he used that cruiser to approach some of the victims. He was actually impersonating an officer. So it wasn't just a case of mistaken identity. It was a calculated tactic.
Wow. He really exploited that vulnerability in the system.
Yeah.
And then there was that significant delay in issuing the public alert, which the commission really criticizes.
Isolate so.
The RCMP seemed reluctant to use social media and other channels, you know?
Yeah, they were really relying on those more traditional methods, which just weren't fast enough.
Especially in that situation.
Yeah. It was like they were stuck in the past. You know, while he was using every tool at his disposal, they were lagging behind. And, you know, that delay had devastating consequences. The report says that some of the victims encountered him after the shootings began before any warning was given.
That's hard to hear, to think that maybe some of those lives could have been saved if the public had known sooner.
It's a tough one to swallow.
So you have that misidentification because of the cruiser, the delayed communication, and then just this clear underestimation of what he was actually capable of.
It's like they were caught completely off guard.
And just struggled to adapt.
And that lack of adaptability, you know, it's one of the key factors the commission highlights.
Yeah.
They weren't prepared for this.
Yeah.
And their response was reactive, not proactive. But what's important about the report is that they don't just criticize. You know,
mm-hmm.
They offer those very specific, actionable recommendations for the RCMP to improve its response in the future.
Okay, so we've covered a lot. You know, we talked about the perpetrator, the replica cruiser, The initial mistakes in the RCMP's response. What's next? Where do we go from here in understanding this the scope of this tragedy?
Next, we need to delve deeper into that RCMP critical incident response.
Yeah.
Talk about those communication failures, the really agonizingly slow rollout of that public alert.
Right.
You know, we need to examine that command structure. Mm-hmm. What went wrong? And we also need to explore the aftermath, the investigations, the impact on the communities, and the systems that were put in place to support the survivors and their families.
It's important to remember this isn't just about the 22 people who lost their lives. It's about everyone whose lives were irrevocably changed because of what happened.
And it's about taking responsibility to prevent it from happening again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by understanding the failures, the choices, and all those incredibly complex factors that led to this awful outcome, we can work towards creating a safer and more resilient society.
And I think that's a good place to pause for now. We've covered a lot of some really difficult material. When we come back, we'll unpack that critical incident response. We'll analyze the RCMP's actions. And most importantly, we'll see what we can learn to do better in the future.
Sounds good.
We left off talking about understanding those actions by the RCMP during the mass casualty. And you flagged some sections in the report that really focus on that initial command structure. What did you find
most significant? I think, in those first 2 hours. You know, the report really depicts this scene of confusion and a real lack of clear leadership, you know.
Yeah.
And remember, this all happened late on a Saturday night in a rural area.
Right.
So the first responders, they were mostly general duty officers.
Yeah.
You know, not a specialized team.
Yeah.
Like you might expect for a critical incident of this scale.
Yeah, and that lack of preparedness for this type of event, especially in a rural setting, it's something the commission really stresses needs to change.
Yeah.
They call for better training and resources, so officers in all areas are equipped to handle these situations.
Absolutely. It's not enough to just hope that it won't happen in a smaller community.
Right. Hoping isn't a strategy.
No.
What I found really concerning from the report is that there wasn't a designated scene commander on site during those first few hours. It sounds like a supervisor at the Operational Communications Center was trying to manage things remotely.
Yeah.
But it seems like, you know, no one was really clear on who was in charge or what they should be doing.
Right.
For those of us who aren't familiar with police procedure, what exactly is the OCC and why is a designated scene commander so important?
So think of the OCC, like the central nervous system for the RCMP. You know, that's where all those 911 calls go, where they gather the information.
Yeah.
And then relay it to the officers on the ground.
Got it.
And the scene commander. They're like the conductor of an orchestra, you know, making sure everyone is on the same page, coordinating all the moving parts, especially when you're dealing with something as chaotic as a mass shooting. Without that clear leadership, things can really fall apart.
Yeah. And the report shows that lack of clarity, it really did have serious consequences. Like, there was a miscommunication about containing the perimeter. Around Portapique, the RCMP thought they had the only road in and out blocked off.
Right.
But they were wrong.
He slipped through.
The perpetrator was able to just get away.
Yeah, the report suggests that the RCMP, they didn't fully understand the geography of the area.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't realize there were other ways in and out of Portapique.
It's like even with the best plans, right?
Yeah.
You're still dealing with incomplete information and a lack of local knowledge.
And that can have pretty dire consequences.
It makes me wonder what could they have done differently in those early hours?
Well, the report is really critical of the RCMP's communication strategy.
Okay.
They highlight the failure to use something called the incident activity log.
Break that down for us. What is an incident activity log and why is it so crucial?
So basically, it's a real-time record of everything that's happening during the incident.
Got it.
So the RCMP uses it to track all the incoming information.
Yeah.
The perpetrator's movements,
you
know, what the officers are doing.
Okay.
It's a vital tool for coordinating the response. But in this case,
mm-hmm.
it just wasn't used effectively.
So it's there. But even with a system in place, you still have human error. The report mentions that the log was incomplete and that vital information from the 911 calls was missing.
Yeah. And it wasn't being updated consistently.
Yeah.
So the officers weren't always working with the most current information.
Right.
And that just created more delays,
right?
You know, in identifying him and understanding how big this was.
It's like a cascade.
Yeah.
One problem creates another. And this also contributed to that delay in issuing the public alert.
Right.
probably one of the most scrutinized aspects of the entire response. So let's break down how that all unfolded.
Yeah, so the report talks about this series of missed opportunities and delays and issuing that alert through the alert ready system.
Right.
And there was a lot of back and forth within the RCMP.
Yeah.
You know, about when to use it. They were even hesitant to use other communication, like social media.
Which is strange because, I mean, this was happening at a time when, you know, social media was already a primary source of information for a lot of people, especially during emergencies.
Exactly. It was a huge blind spot. The report says that this hesitation stemmed from a lack of clear policies and training on how to actually use social media effectively.
So it's like they were stuck with this outdated mindset about communication?
Yeah, they were more focused on controlling the message rather than getting that information out there to the public quickly.
Yeah. And again, that delay had devastating consequences.
Yeah. Because the report details how, you know, several victims actually encountered the perpetrator after the shooting started, before any warning was even issued.
It just makes you think, you know, how many lives could have been saved if they had just, you know, let people know sooner.
It's a heavy question.
But the commission, they really emphasize how important communication is during these events.
Yeah.
And then it's a matter of, you know, life or death. And their recommendations, they don't just stop at criticizing the RCMP, you know. They also go into the alert ready system itself, how effective it is, how accessible it is.
Right. It's not enough to just blame them for not using a system properly. We need to look at the system itself.
Yeah, because it has limitations.
It does.
Especially in terms of how quickly it can reach people and how many people it can reach.
Exactly.
So what needs to be done? What are they recommending?
They're saying we should explore other channels.
Okay.
Like using social media more effectively.
Uh-huh.
Even developing more localized warning systems, you know, tailored to the needs of rural communities. It's about having options, being flexible, making sure those systems are really serving the people.
One of the most, I think, gut-wrenching parts of the report was reading about how the RCMP communicated with the victims' families.
Oh, yeah.
They were often left in the dark, you know, desperate for information about their loved ones.
The victim liaison services were totally inadequate.
Yeah.
Especially for an event of this magnitude.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have the staff to handle all those inquiries.
Mm-hmm.
And the information they did give out, it was often incomplete. Or just inconsistent.
So on top of everything else, they were going through that level of grief and uncertainty.
It's just awful.
It's unimaginable. The report says this really just intensified their trauma.
Yeah. And the commission is very clear, you know, an effective response, it means more than just catching the perpetrator.
Right.
You have to provide that timely and compassionate support to the families.
Yeah.
To the victims. It's about recognizing the human impact of these events.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to mitigate that suffering.
So we've talked about that initial response, the communication breakdowns, the delayed public alert. But what about, you know, what happened after? How did they handle the investigation, the process of actually learning from this tragedy?
That's where things get even more complicated.
Okay.
Because one of the key findings is that the RCMP, they didn't conduct any comprehensive operational debriefings.
Yeah.
You know, after the event.
Really?
Imagine going through something like that and not having a chance to really process it.
Yeah.
To talk about what happened, what went wrong, what went right.
Yeah.
A lot of the officers involved, they never got that chance.
It just seems like a missed opportunity for some really crucial learning, you know? How can you improve if you don't even take the time to analyze what happened?
Exactly. And the commission, they recommend mandatory debriefings.
Yeah.
After all critical incidents.
Okay.
It's about creating that culture of learning and accountability.
Yeah.
Where mistakes are acknowledged and addressed.
So did they do a formal review of the response?
That's probably the most frustrating part. They started an after-action review.
Okay.
But it was never finished.
Really?
Yeah. There were all these delays, bureaucratic hurdles, and just a lack of political will to see it through.
So they had a chance to learn from this, but they just didn't follow through.
Yeah.
Like they were hoping it would just go away if they ignored it.
Unfortunately, it's a pattern we see all too often.
And the commission, they have some serious concerns about this lack of follow through. You know, they say that without a transparent review process, the RCMP risks making those same mistakes again. And this really points to a much broader issue of police accountability. You know, if a police force can fail this badly and then not even investigate its own actions, what does that say about the systems that we have in place? to hold them accountable.
It's a question we need to answer.
So the RCMP's response, it was flawed on multiple levels. There were those communication breakdowns, those delays, a failure to adapt to a very dangerous and evolving situation.
Right. But the report isn't just about highlighting what went wrong.
Yeah.
You know, it's also about providing that roadmap for the future.
Yeah.
Outlining those steps
yeah.
that the RCMP can take to improve its response.
And those recommendations are, I mean, they're really wide-ranging.
They are.
From tactical responses to communication protocols.
And even deeper issues.
Yes.
Like police culture, accountability.
A need for better training and resources,
mm.
especially in rural communities.
Yeah. Because this tragedy, it was a result of choices, systemic failures, and a lack of preparedness.
Yeah.
For the unexpected.
But we can learn from this. We can't change what happened. But we can use this report as a call to action, not just for the RCMP, but for all of us. It's a reminder that we all play a role in creating a society that's more resilient to violence.
Absolutely. That's a really powerful message.
And speaking of community, you also flagged some sections that focus on their role
yeah.
in all this. What was it that stood out to you?
Well, despite everything that happened,
yeah.
the report also shows incredible courage.
Mm.
And resilience,
yeah.
you know, within those communities.
Yeah.
There are stories about neighbors helping neighbors, providing shelter, warning others, even confronting the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
It really shows the strength of the human spirit,
mm-hmm.
even in the face of something so awful.
Yeah. It's like this counter narrative to the, you know, the perpetrator's cruelty
hmm.
and the failures that allowed him to do this.
Right. It also highlights how important community-based policing is. You know,
right.
building that trust between law enforcement and the community.
Because that trust is so essential.
It is. For effective crime prevention and response, when communities feel safe reporting things, sharing information with the police, everyone benefits.
But the report also talks about those unique challenges
yeah.
that rural communities face, you know, those limited resources, the isolation, that feeling that they're often overlooked
yep.
by larger urban centers.
And the commission is saying that these challenges need to be addressed,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
at a policy level.
Mm.
They need more support.
Yeah.
and resources to build those safe and resilient environments.
It's recognizing that public safety isn't a one-size-fits-all approach.
Exactly.
And then, you yeah. know, the public warning system itself, earlier we talked about the delay, but the report also looks at how effective that system is,
yeah.
how accessible it is in rural communities.
Right. The commission, they do say that the alert ready system has its limitations.
Yeah.
You know, not everyone has a device. And there are worries about the system being overwhelmed during those large-scale emergencies.
To what can we do?
They suggest finding different ways to communicate.
Yeah.
Better use of social media. Maybe even develop some localized warning systems.
Oh.
You know, specific to each community.
Mm-hmm.
It's about being adaptable, having options.
One thing that really stood out to me in the report was the lasting impact this had
yeah.
on the mental health of the community, the first
yes.
responders, the people who were there that night. Even those involved in the investigation.
Oh, absolutely.
We know trauma has a lasting impact. And the commission, they really stressed how important it is to provide that support to everyone, not just the families, not just the victims, but that whole wider circle of people who are affected by this tragedy.
Yeah. They call for better training for first responders,
mm.
not just on how to handle those events, but also on how to recognize the signs of PTSD.
Right.
You know, in themselves.
Yeah.
In their colleagues.
And where to go for help.
Exactly.
To talk about those community-based mental health services.
Yeah.
You know, for providing that long-term support.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
fostering resilience.
Yeah. It's recognizing that healing from something like this, it's a long process. It takes a community.
Okay. So we've covered a lot of ground. We've talked about the perpetrator, the response, the community, the warning systems, the lasting impact.
It's a lot to take in.
Yeah. But there's one more thing that we need to explore. Those commission recommendations. What they actually mean for preventing future violence.
And that's where we'll pick up in the final part. Because
yeah.
these recommendations, they go way beyond just improving procedures.
Right.
They really get at the root causes of violence.
We've spent a lot of time, you know, going over what went wrong, but the real heart of this report is in those recommendations. The commission really gives us this this roadmap, a way forward. And I think that's where we need to focus our energy. So what are some of those key areas they highlight?
One of the things that really stood out to me is how the commission emphasizes that, you know, preventing future tragedies, it requires this really fundamental shift in how we think about and address gender-based violence.
Yeah, we can't just react after the fact. We have to address those root causes, you know, challenge those harmful stereotypes, and really foster a culture of respect and equality. It's a big task, but it's something we have to do.
It seems like so much of this tragedy was really rooted in that failure to recognize and address those warning signs of domestic violence. And the report, it really hammers home that point over and over. We need a more comprehensive approach.
Yeah. The call for more education, awareness campaigns, early intervention programs, better support for survivors. It has to be this whole of society approach. You know,
yeah.
Everyone has a role to play.
And they go beyond just those recommendations for social change. Like, they have very specific actions. Increased funding for those violence prevention programs.
Yeah.
Better training for law enforcement. Stricter legal consequences for those who perpetuate this kind of harm.
Right. They also talk about firearms access.
Yeah.
Remember the perpetrator? He had that history of illegally possessing firearms.
Right. And the report, it really details how he was able to amass this whole arsenal, despite all those red flags.
Right. And it makes you wonder, what can we do to prevent something like that from happening again?
Yeah. The commission, they recommend stricter gun control measures.
Like
a ban on assault-style weapons.
Yeah.
More rigorous background checks. Maybe a national licensing system.
It feels like this is a conversation we've been having for a long time.
It is.
But this tragedy just really drives home the urgency.
Absolutely. And they also talk about going beyond just stricter laws.
Yeah.
You know, they talk about better enforcement of the regulations we already have, improved data collection on gun ownership, and really addressing those social and economic factors that contribute to gun violence.
Mm-hmm.
Things like poverty, inequality.
It's recognizing that all these issues are interconnected.
Exactly.
And it's a complex problem. And the commission does acknowledge that. But they make it very clear that we can't ignore it anymore.
Right.
The human cost is just, it's too high.
It's about being proactive, you know, about safety and well-being, not just reacting after something terrible happens.
And let's not forget about the public warning system.
Yeah.
We talked about the delayed alert in this case, but the report goes deeper. Examines the effectiveness of the alert ready system itself, especially in those rural communities.
Right. Because they acknowledge it has limitations. Not everyone has access. And, you know, there's that concern about it being overwhelmed during a major event. They suggest maybe using social media more effectively, even developing those localized warning systems.
Right.
That are tailored to different communities. So it's about, you know, having options.
Yeah.
Being flexible. And making sure those systems are serving the people they're designed to protect.
So we've got these recommendations for addressing gender-based violence, stricter gun control measures, and a pretty significant overhaul of the public warning system. That's a lot. But it sounds like they've given us a pretty solid plan for change.
They have. But recommendations are only as good as our commitment to putting them into action. It's going to take real political will, resources, a collective effort from everyone to actually make this happen.
The Nova Scotia mass casualty was, I mean, it was a wake-up call. It exposed those vulnerabilities in our systems. And it forced us to confront some really hard truths about ourselves, about our communities, and the institutions that are supposed to keep us safe.
Yeah. But even amidst all that tragedy, you know, there's hope.
Yeah.
Because the report, with its thoroughness, its compassion, and its real commitment to finding solutions, it shows that we can learn from the past and work towards something better.
So what does this mean for you, the listener, years after this event? What can you take away from this this deep dive?
It means understanding that we all have a role to play in this.
Yeah.
In preventing violence.
Right.
You know, we can challenge those harmful attitudes, support survivors, advocate for change, hold those institutions accountable. We need to be aware. Recognize the warning signs and speak up. We can't just be passive bystanders.
We can honor those that we lost by taking action, by working towards a future where this doesn't happen again. This deep dive has been tough.
It has.
You know, it's forced us to look at some really dark parts of humanity, but it's also been a reminder of, you know, the resilience of the human spirit, the power of compassion. And the importance of community, even when faced with this unimaginable loss, there's always hope.
That's what we have to hold on to.
And this tragedy, it showed us that silence isn't an option. We have to speak up, demand action, and work together to make sure that everyone can live free from fear.
It's a challenge, but it's one that we can't ignore.
This has been The Deep Dive. We leave you with this thought. What if everyone took this report to heart? Embrace those recommendations, really committed to making a difference. What kind of world could we create?
It's a question worth thinking about.
It's a future worth fighting for.